You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, can rural America be saved? Our next guest says that's the wrong question. We'll find out how rural America is saving itself and talk about what economic success looks like for rural parts of the country. First, with a month to go and a disappointing season that saw the Green Bay Packers miss the playoffs for the second straight year, Mike McCarthy was fired as the team's head coach. After interviewing 10 candidates last week, the team hired Matt LaFleur to be the 15th head coach in team history. Pete Doherty joins us now to discuss the hire and what it can mean for the future of the team. Pete is a Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and PackerNews.com. Pete, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, looking back first, Pete, Mike McCarthy fired during the season, not something you hear, you see all the time, not something we've seen a lot with the Packers over the decades. Why did they make that decision to pull the trigger then?
Yeah, very rare around here. They've never explicitly said why. The sense that I got was that things had deteriorated, the working atmosphere, the environment, had slipped enough because of basically Aaron Rodgers wasn't buying what McCarthy was selling anymore. And I think the environment had become poisoned enough where after that Arizona loss where they got beaten pretty badly by a warm weather team at Lambeau Field in December, I think they just said that they had to clear that atmosphere. And so removing the coach at that time, basically took Rodgers and McCarthy out of the same room and kind of lifted that pall over. It also gave him a chance to openly start on the search for a new coach, but they could do that stuff behind the scenes if they had wanted to. I think it was mostly just to clear the to make for a better working environment for the last month of the season.
Now tell us about the new guy, Matt LaFleur. What are some of the highlights on his resume?
He's spent most of his career in the NFL. I think it's 9 years working with either Kyle Shanahan, who's the San Francisco 49ers coach, or Sean McVay, the Rams coach. He's worked 9 of his 11 years or whatever it is in the NFL with one or both of those guys on the same staff. They're kind of looked at as the cutting edge offensive coaches in the league right now, or two of them anyway. They're both younger guys, and LaFleur kind of fits in with them, and he's worked with one or both for most of his time in the NFL. So I think the Packers were hoping that he's got the same kind of mindset and approach to offensive football as those other two do.
Right. That was one of the gripes about Mike McCarthy and being an offensive coach and his offense looking, boring, a little outdated. When you'd watch some of these other teams, they're doing all this zany stuff that's working really well. Is that the hope that this is the fix for what people saw as a little lackluster performance on the offensive side?
Yeah, I think so. And, it's, this is getting, way above my pay grade as far as being able to understand, how offenses, really actually work and play calling. All these coaches have so much, just reams and reams of information, pages of information on, tendencies and all those things and every opponent they play. So it's, you're really getting into the weeds there. They all come from the same offense. McCarthy's mentor was a guy named Paul Hackett, who hired him at the University of Pittsburgh and then took him to the Kansas City Chiefs in 1993. Hackett worked for Bill Walsh, with the 49ers when they were winning Super Bowls. And the offense LaFleur runs comes from Mike Shanahan, who also worked for Walsh at pretty much the same time. So they start at the same place, but it appears as though the McVay-Kyle Shanahan, that's Mike Shanahan's son, it appears as though their offense has evolved more in the past, 6 or 7 years than the McCarthy offense has.
Talking to Pete Doherty from the Green Bay Press Gazette about the new head coach of the Green Bay Packers, Matt LaFleur. They don't hire a lot of coaches over time. Kind of a big deal. Now, on this Packer team, Pete, there's a bunch of young guys, and there's this Hall of Famer of the future named Aaron Rodgers. How important is that relationship for the new coach?
Don't want to say it's everything, but maybe it's everything. The reason I still don't see much difference between the Packers of 2016 and the Packers of last season, other than Aaron Rodgers, when he talked about running the table, he went on this great run where he played MVP football and they won 6 straight and then two playoff games and got to the NFC Championship. And this year he never played anywhere near that level. and they ended up going, 6-9-1. That's the difference between 10-6 and getting the championship at 6-9-1. So that's the, I think that's the major part of it. So yeah, getting things right with the quarterback, getting him where he's fully engaged, fully buying into the system, has complete trust and respect for the coach. That's going to be huge, and that'll probably end up determining, assuming that Rodgers still physically can still do it and that he's not in decline, that'll end up determining just how Matt LaFleur's first 3 or 4 or 5 years go.
A lot of times when a team brings in a new head coach, they sweep clean, hire all new coordinators and such. Packers kept Mike Pettine after his first year as defensive coordinator. What do you think of that move?
So, I mean, I don't know what you thought or what a lot of the fans thought.
I thought the defense was injured, and so I don't know what their coordinator could do about it.
Yeah, and you know, the stats weren't great. You know, they weren't bottom of the barrel, but they weren't great. But just the eyeball test, you know, I felt like in a lot of those games when they needed stops late, you know, in the fourth quarter and the second half to stay in the game, they got the stops, and the problem was they weren't getting the points. So while it wasn't a really good defense, I thought it was fine. It was good enough. Did well for the personnel they had for the reasons you suggest there. They did get killed by injuries as the season went on. So I thought it was I would have called it a fairly promising first season. And I think he was probably smart to keep Pettine on. And now they're not starting at square one on defense as well as on offense. They don't have to start over there.
We've got all this excitement, of course, the NFL playoffs going on, Super Bowl on the way, Packers not participating. What are you watching for the Packers offseason when it comes to free agents, drafts? What kind of changes do the Packers need to make?
You know, you get the feeling they're going to be fairly active in free agency. I think they're depending on who they cut in the next couple months. They could end up with, I don't know, $45, $50 million in cap room. So then the question is, do they go after a big-ticket guy who will take up, you know, maybe as much as a third of that money? I don't know if there will be a pass rusher available or not. There's a few who are supposed to be, but those guys always end up getting their contracts extended or franchise tagged. You know, Le'Veon Bell, they go after a running back like that and hope he can make a difference for a couple of years, or do they go more for a lot of bargain signings and mid-level signings and just try to get marginally better at a lot of different positions? So that's one thing I'll be watching, is just whether do they go for a big-ticket impact guy, or do they try to a scattershot approach and go for adding a number of guys and hoping that they find a gem in there and maybe just improve at a few other positions at least a little bit.
We'll watch for that and wait till next year. Pete, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
Pete Dougherty is a Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and PackersNews.com. He joined us to talk about the hiring of Matt LaFleur as the Packers' next head coach and what it means for the team's outlook heading into the offseason. Coming up, our next guest says we need to rethink what economic success looks like if we want our rural communities to thrive. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about a new series in the New York Times that looks at how the rights of women are affected by granting rights to the unborn. First, recent commentary in various news organizations has asked and tried to answer the question, can we save rural America? Some analysts have said that no one, from policymakers to people who actually live there, seems to know quite how to succeed. But our next guest says this idea that no one knows how to solve the challenges of the rural parts of the country is misleading. Gene Hardy is a doctoral candidate at the University of Michigan School of Information. He wrote the recent City Lab piece, How Rural America is Saving Itself. Gene, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How's it going?
Good. Well, now, why is it problematic for you when you see headlines like, can rural America be saved? And this implication that somebody has to swoop in from the outside to save rural America.
Well, I think that you just answered that question, right? Is that oftentimes when people are asking these questions, how can rural America be saved? They're not necessarily asking it from the perspective of a rural person. It's usually someone like a writer at the New York Times asking this question.
Now, you've worked in researching rural communities, especially in Michigan and Wisconsin. What kind of stories do you see in rural communities that you say, yeah, these are success stories?
I've been doing a lot of research recently in the Keweenaw Peninsula, of the Upper Peninsula, which is a very, very remote region. It's about a four-hour drive from the nearest metropolitan area. And people there are very proud of their region and very proud of their heritage and what's going on there. And they do a phenomenal job of building community organizations and partnerships to support each other in their endeavors. And there's lots of You wouldn't expect, say, a college town like Houghton, Michigan, which is a college town of 7,000 people, to have, you know, two business accelerators, co-working spaces, and all of these other things that people often associate with urban areas. But they're there, and that's because people have learned that if they want to be able to have these resources, that they need to develop them for themselves and not expect somebody from the outside to do it for them.
But how about a small community, a town that, say, doesn't have something like Michigan Tech there? Are there ways they can do similar things to solve some of the challenges of rural communities?
Definitely. I mean, it's a lot harder when you don't have larger institutions like a college maybe footing some of the bill. But there are definitely ways that you can do that. Oftentimes, economic developers use this process called placemaking, wherein they kind of evaluate what is like special about a place and then make development decisions based upon that. Many rural areas are in what we like to call kind of amenity-rich places, where people like to enjoy the outdoors, do things like mountain biking, skiing, snowshoeing. So economic developers take a lot of those things into account when they're making the decisions to kind of move a place forward. When you have a small town that is in an amenity-rich location, but it's not necessarily taking advantage of those amenities to the best of its ability, it's the kind of the economic developer's job and local, you know, municipalities to make sure that they're kind of moving in a direction to where they can kind of take advantage of those amenities. But that's also, I mean, that kind of, I think we frequently fall into this kind of trap of being able to kind of measure what success looks like.
Right.
And that is usually like very active and, you know, constantly growing and all these other things.
Right. That's a point you raised in your City Lab piece, that we might have one model of success that we look at in a big city that involves, hey, we brought in this huge technology company or this this group of startups that's growing and rapidly increasing local revenue. Mm-hmm. You say maybe we need to have some other definitions of success.
Yeah, I mean, what people perceive to be success is exactly like attracting big outside business, you know, population growth. High tech businesses are obviously a huge thing right now, as we saw with the case of the second Amazon headquarters and what's going on with Foxconn down in Racine. So that is kind of like that is the bar that these communities are supposed to be hitting. But when you live in a town of like 2,000 people, of which probably employment is steady. There's not necessarily the opportunity to kind of bring in these high-tech businesses. Instead, I think what we need to be thinking about, rather, is what resources do towns need and do people that live in these places need in order to kind of live the lifestyles that they want to live. And I think this goes back to issues around sustainability. Every town in every rural region isn't going to be this kind of poster child for success. Part of what I want to be doing is understanding what people in local regions kind of perceive to be success.
Talking to Gene Hardy from the University of Michigan School of Information about a piece he wrote in City Lab called How Rural America is Saving Itself. Gene, I spent a day at a visioning community visioning session in mm-hmm. Princeton, Wisconsin, a small town, and I heard from people from high school students to retirees. All the things they loved about living in a community that size, for one thing, with the kind of access to nature, whether it's hunting, fishing, boating, other forms of recreation. We have a lot in our smaller communities that people want to live there. Are we
exactly.
going to be able to, how do we harness that to make it economically viable? Because the other thing I heard from people is like, I love it. I don't know if I could stay here because I don't have a job.
I mean, that's a big question, right? And that's wages are an issue around the world, and access to, I mean, around the United States, and access to education is also an issue. So one of the big issues that I'm hearing from business owners and economic developers, as well as kind of like people, like everyday citizens, is that there's kind of a mismatch between like expectation of labor and wages. And a lot of it comes down to a lack of affordable access to education. So the past 20 years have obviously seen states kind of continue to defund education at a drastic scale. Obviously, circa 2008 was kind of the peak of that, and we've been fortunate enough to kind of see some of that rebound. But people don't necessarily have access to the education, whether that's a bachelor's degree or an associate's degree or even vocational education in high school. There's just less of that available. So oftentimes, business owners don't necessarily think that they can kind of attract and find the kind of people that they need. So I think that there's this weird disconnect here, and that business owners don't necessarily see the labor that they want. So they're not offering the wages that maybe local people really need, and local people can't necessarily get access to the education easily that would allow them to get those higher wages. So obviously rural America has a poverty problem. I mean, urban areas also have a poverty problem, but I think in particular rural areas have fewer resources to kind of address poverty issues that aren't social. Obviously, rural areas have a phenomenal are known for phenomenal tight-knit communities that can offer social support. But I think a lot of it comes down to that access to education.
Another thing that people often refer to as a problem, but you say, hey, maybe it could be an opportunity, is the aging of the rural population. As often younger people move out, there aren't maybe enough kids to support that local school district. How can that be turned into an opportunity, though?
That's a really good question, Rob. I don't necessarily have an answer for that, to be honest. That was just something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, because people often have these conversations like, oh, we need to attract more young people. We need to get more young people to move to our community. But every rural area is not going to be able to attract masses of young people to move there. So at that point, you have to flip that question, and you have to be asking yourself, so what can we do with the people that we have? Like, oh, if we are actually attracting a lot of retirees, and a lot of, you know, the Upper Peninsula and Northern Wisconsin, a lot of rural communities attract a lot of retirees because they like the quality of life. So how then, I think the question then becomes, then how do we take the kind of experiences of aging populations and turn that into something that can be utilized in moving forward? So for example, I'm in Iron River, Michigan right now, and they had a school close. But instead of just, you know, keeping it abandoned, it's become a community center where a lot of organizations, especially organizations that serve the elderly, have been able to find low-cost access to facilities in order to provide opportunities for this aging population in the region.
Now, given that there's probably not a one-size-fits-all approach for all different rural communities, how can we direct, you mentioned earlier, assets? How can we direct assets to local communities to empower them, I guess, to come up with their own solutions?
Yeah, that's another great question, Rob, that I'm not necessarily a policy person. So I research, you know, how people live their everyday lives and how technology and community kind of come together in unique ways, particularly in rural communities. But one thing I'm seeing as I get more involved with economic development organizations is so much of what they have access to is especially at the municipal level, is actually state-sponsored loans rather than grants. And an issue that comes with most state and federal loans is that they require matching funds. And if a small community doesn't necessarily have the capital to generate matching funds, then they don't have access to those loans. So I'm being very pie in the sky here right now, right? And I would love to see a drastic shift in the amount of grants that are offered to local municipalities and to economic development organizations in rural areas to support the kind of development work. I think people perceive that there needs to be that every single community needs, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars in investment. But a lot of these communities would love to be able to do projects that cost, you know, $100,000, $500,000. If the tax structure in the United States was a little different, we would very easily be able to kind of fund that work.
You mentioned technology, and a lot of people point toward the need for rural high-speed internet, rural broadband. Is that an important part of the puzzle?
Oh, definitely. I mean, one of the things, you talk to every single rural person, and internet connection is a major issue. The problem here, though, is that, I mean, kind of as so the way that I see it is that as soon as rural areas kind of catch up to urban areas in broadband speeds, urban areas are catch up, you know, for example, you know, wherever urban areas are right now, whenever rural areas kind of reach that level, urban areas are going to be vastly ahead of rural areas. So there's always going to be this cat and mouse game. So for me, I think that we have to simultaneously understand that, yes, rural areas need access to affordable and high quality, high speed internet. But at the same time, the work that I do is really trying to encourage tech companies to think about rural people when they're designing their technologies. I mean, a lot of us know, like, whenever we're updating our smartphones, that the file sizes keep getting larger and larger. And technology companies keep, you know, designing technologies that require larger and larger bandwidth. And as rural areas continue to kind of trail behind, we need to be thinking more about what bandwidth and file size requirements are necessary to kind of engage on a sort of day-to-day basis as a digitally informed citizen.
Do you think on an issue like that, technology issue, maybe on policy issues too, people from urban areas who are making some of these decisions are starting at least to pay more attention to the needs of rural America?
I think so. I think actually where they're paying the most attention is actually in the developing world outside of the United States. So Google and other large companies have, you know, I mean, Facebook has an app that you can download that is designed with developing communities in mind. So I think that these companies are starting to kind of recognize that, you know, not everybody has access to high-speed internet, and they're trying to make informed decisions. Unfortunately, as we kind of progress into this kind of digital age or whatever you want to call it, they need to work harder and they need to work faster to make sure that rural people and people, I mean, you know, rural people everywhere, not just in the United States, are included in this.
Gene, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Gene Hardy, doctoral candidate at the University of Michigan School of Information. He wrote a recent piece in CityLab called How Rural America is Saving Itself. Coming up, we'll find out how state laws around the country designed to protect fetuses are leading to a wide variety of criminal charges against women. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to an expert on youth safety about Jamie Kloss's dramatic escape and how child abduction cases are investigated. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a new series from the New York Times editorial board is taking a closer look at the way pregnant women are being treated today in the American legal system. Over 8 editorials, they look at a trend of granting more rights and protections to fetuses and how that trend is affecting the rights of women. Lauren Kelly is a member of the New York Times editorial board, where she focuses on women and reproductive rights. She spearheaded the project at the Times and was part of the team that reported and edited the series. Lauren, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What got you and your colleagues started on this path of covering laws meant to protect fetuses and how that affects women?
Sure. So this is a topic that I have covered for some time, for about a decade. But I think for us on the board, it really became an urgent issue, really the moment that Anthony Kennedy's retirement from the Supreme Court news was announced. Really immediately, it was clear to me and some of my colleagues that the road ahead of us is going to be, you know, paved with a lot of debate about abortion, and that it was likely that whoever Trump did nominate to the Supreme Court would likely lead to Roe being rolled back, if not entirely overturned.
But already in the United States, even under Roe versus Wade, there have been a lot of changes in the laws over the years, many of them involved in protecting fetuses, the unborn. It depends on who you talk to, which language they use. What kind of laws have we seen at the state level on this issue?
Sure. So there have been many hundreds of anti-abortion bills that have been introduced, and I believe it's something like 400 that have been passed in recent years. And, you know, those really run the gamut. You know, there might be waiting periods before a woman can have an abortion. There might be various regulations on abortion clinics. For instance, they might have to widen their hallways or do other sorts of work before they can open their clinics again. And then, you know, in addition to that, there are these what are called fetal homicide laws, which are a lot about a lot of the focus of our series. 38 states and actually federally, there is a law for this as well, have these laws right now. They treat a fetus as a potential crime victim that is separate and apart from the woman who is carrying it. And so that opens up, you know, all sorts of questions about the rights that those women will still have.
Right. You have a chart, actually, that kind of a flow chart, and you say this has happened in more than one state where initially a crime, maybe an attempted homicide, results in a miscarriage, the death of a fetus. Laws are passed to punish people who do such a thing, but then in many cases are applied to pregnant women themselves.
Yeah, that's right. You know, these are somewhat understandable circumstances. I mean, you hear about some of these crimes and they really are absolutely tragic and horrific. You know, a pregnant woman being murdered is absolutely awful. And you can understand the desire to bring justice to somebody, you know, for also killing that fetus. The problem is, of course, then women's rights end up getting taken away. And so you really have to look at an appropriate legal response to those sorts of crimes.
We're talking to Lauren Kelly, member of the New York Times editorial board, about a series on largely about laws intended to protect fetuses from harm and the impact that's having on the rights of women, pregnant women in particular. Lauren, what kind of crimes, what kind of cases have you seen where women are charged perhaps after a miscarriage?
Sure. Here's one example. There's a woman who fell down the stairs. She tripped over, she already had a child or a couple of children, and she tripped over one of their toys and fell down the stairs, ended up losing the pregnancy, and was accused then of endangering her children. Even though falling down the stairs is not a crime, if, you know, I am not pregnant right now, and if I were to fall down the stairs, I would not be charged with anything, you know, other than whatever, you know, medical care I needed from falling down the stairs. But if you are pregnant, suddenly these things can become crimes. And those are the sorts of, you know, tragic situations that we looked at in the series.
And you write about efforts maybe to police pregnant women, charges if a woman was in a car accident, not wearing a seatbelt, and she was pregnant. Women using drugs, legal or illegal.
Yes, that's right. All of those things have happened. The car accident incident is another tragic one. A woman in New York was in a car accident. She was not wearing her seatbelt. It turns out she may have been at fault in this case and hit two people in another car, and those people passed away. She also lost her pregnancy, but she was charged ultimately for the death of her fetus, and not for the deaths of the two adults who were driving the other car.
So at the core of this is a philosophical issue, a rise, as you describe it, of people passing these laws for fetal protection, saying that a fetus, an unborn child, is the moral equivalent of an adult human being. And you're worried at a root level about what this does to the rights of women.
Yes, that's right. You know, I think with the series, one thing we really wanted to make clear was that, yes, the future of Roe v. Wade is at stake. We don't know what's going to happen there. But we wanted to make it clear that this is really a broader issue than just about abortion. Abortion rights are very important, of course. But really, this is about bodily autonomy very broadly. And whether or not Roe is overturned, I think we can expect in the coming years and possibly even months to see a proliferation of more of these laws rolling back women's rights.
And you pointed toward, I don't remember if it was Justice Kennedy himself, but one of the Supreme Court justices saying if fetal personhood becomes the law of the land, that would in effect render Roe versus Wade obsolete. Is that right?
Yes, it wasn't Kennedy, but that was in the Roe decision itself. And that is absolutely correct.
We're talking about a series from the New York Times editorial board called A Woman's Rights. It looks at the fetus personhood movement and how it's affecting the rights of women. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about a fetal personhood laws? Do you think there should be protections in those kind of laws so that pregnant women don't face prosecution, potentially jail time, like some of the stories we've heard? Do you think it's a good idea to have specific laws protecting the well-being of fetuses of unborn children? Have you yourself been in a legal situation for similar issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about a New York Times series looking at laws intended to protect fetuses and their impact, those laws' impact on pregnant women and their rights. Lauren Kelly is with us. She's a member of the New York Times editorial board who focuses on women and reproductive rights. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do some of these stories we've heard concern you? Do you think prosecuting pregnant women in the event of a miscarriage, saying that they were negligent in some way, is the right or wrong approach? What do you think of the idea of these kind of legal protections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren, before we go to our callers, one of your pieces looked at a case where the government was trying to protect fetuses from women, the crack baby scare of the 1980s, based on, it turned out, faulty science. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. That piece we felt very strongly about doing because, as you said, this sort of myth of quote-unquote crack babies was really propagated a lot at the time by media organizations. And we really felt it was important for us to make clear that the New York Times was one of those organizations. And, you know, really, a lot of these myths about these, again, quote unquote, crack babies, you know, some of the myths were that these children would grow up to be predators, that they would, you know, be criminals, that they would be damaged for life. And it turns out that science and those, you know, those articles that were written, a lot of it was just not true. And, you know, I think that I am certain that our reporters at the time were, you know, acting in good faith and doing their best. But it just turns out that none of that was correct, or large amounts of it were incorrect. So we just felt it was really important to address that and help set the record straight, especially because one of our stories deals with the opioid epidemic and a woman who is addicted to opioids. And we just thought it was important to make clear how that crack era myth really helped set the stage for some of the policies and the social attitudes that we have today about pregnant women and mothers who are addicted to drugs.
Let's go to our callers now. Michael is with us in Johnson Creek. Michael, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Michael?
I was actually thinking about, for what your caller said about the story that she's doing or whatever. My thing is that I'm pro-choice. I am against late-term abortions. But one of the things I think that people aren't also thinking about is, how about after the baby is born? If a mother, let's say, she wanted to get an abortion but she can't, and she doesn't want to keep the child, she gives up the child to adoption, well, who's going to adopt the baby? Who's going to take care of it? Who's going to foot the bill for that kind of stuff? And then how is the child going to turn out in the end?
Michael, thanks for the call. Michael worried about taking care of kids after they're born as much as abortion itself, Lauren.
Yeah, I mean, all I can say is that I completely agree. And, you know, women's health care should really include, in my view, a whole range of things from abortion care to prenatal care to postnatal care. And, of course, care for those infants after they're born, of course.
Michael, thanks for the call. Go to Matt, also in Johnson Creek. Matt, hi.
Hello. My question would be, has anyone thought about the legal ramifications of the actual birthday when we apply personhood to a fetus, i.e. does somebody get to vote now at 17 years, 3 months? Because many of our laws, actually, the crux of them is the actual birthday. So how are we going to treat that if we treat a in utero fetus as a person with rights? Thank you.
Matt, thanks for the call. Any thoughts, Lauren?
Yeah, it's actually a really wonderful question. That really gets to the heart of some of the really slippery legal and almost philosophical questions that arise when we start treating fetuses as people from the moment of conception. There actually was a case pretty recently where a man in Kansas who had been charged with statutory rape of a teenage girl, his lawyers tried to argue in court, unsuccessfully as it turns out, that the girl was 9 months older than she actually is based on Kansas's personhood law. Again, they were unsuccessful in that, as they should have been. But, you know, it does raise questions, and some of them are quite disturbing.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Lauren Kelly, member of the New York Times editorial board, where she focuses on women and reproductive rights. Looking at a series there, looking at mostly at fetal protection laws and their implications for the rights of women. We'll go to another caller now. Steve is with us in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi. Yeah, my comment's probably a little bit off topic, but it is related. You know, my biggest concern is I have no idea when life begins, so I think 3 months or 4 months for having an abortion is fine. But I want to know what the guests' feelings are about why should a man be able to forego his parental rights and not have to pay child support? Provide him the same choice that a woman has. Would the guests support that?
Steve, thanks for the call. Lauren?
You know, I'm not even sure that I can answer that. That was not a big focus of this series.
All right. Thanks for the call, Steve. We'll go to Sean on the line in Wausau. Sean, hi.
Hi, Mike and Lauren. Thank you for your time. I was just kind of curious on where you kind of draw the line. Of course, I'd want women's rights to be protected as well as unborn or, you know, even after a child's born's rights. Where is the line drawn? Kind of like a previous caller, it's dated.
Mike, thanks for the call. So are there valid protections? Are there valid ways to, offer fetal protection laws, Lauren, without endangering rights of women?
You know, it's a really great question. And I think that legal scholars can have a really good faith debate about where that line is and should be. I think the reality right now, though, is that, again, the assault is really on women's rights right now. So I think that there is just a lot of work that needs to be done to get us up to the point where women are really seen as full human beings in the eye of the law, to be honest.
Now, every now and then, this issue comes to the forefront, usually with a Supreme Court nomination hearings, but it doesn't seem like abortion rights, pro-life and pro-choice groups are front and center like they have been at some stages in the past. Are you concerned that this issue is in some ways under the radar in a way it hasn't been in recent decades?
Well, I will say that while Brett Kavanaugh was sort of, you know, rising up to the Supreme Court, it felt like there was quite a lot of sort of discussion about this issue. It does tend to sort of fall away when those news cycles are, you know, sort of no longer in the headlines. I certainly do hope that people keep paying attention to this, though, because there are stories every single day, positive and negative, in terms of where reproductive rights are headed. And, you know, frankly, I think a big reason for that we produced this series is because we wanted people to realize that. We wanted people to realize that, you know, in many cases, women already are vulnerable and their rights are more at risk now than they ever have been. And, you know, we want people to keep paying attention.
Yeah, since the passage of Roe versus Wade, I've seen some pro-choice advocates over the years say this is maybe something that people younger people in particular may just take for granted and not think about. Do you think that that is changing, that maybe younger voters are watching this issue more closely?
I do think that's the case. And what gives me hope is, you know, you see all of the young women who are running for office, often on very strong pro-choice platforms. You know, you see young people flocking to the voting booth. You know, you look at, for instance, the Women's March, tons and tons of young women. You know, I really do think that it's starting to become a reality for younger women who might have taken this for granted perhaps in the past.
We'll leave it there for now. Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Lauren Kelly with the New York Times editorial board. She was with us to talk about a new opinion series there called A Woman's Rights, which looks at how women are impacted by laws granting rights to fetuses. The Foxconn Technology Corporation doesn't have to tell the state until April how many people they've hired for their massive manufacturing plant in southeastern Wisconsin. But students at local technical colleges have already signed up for the degree programs Foxconn has asked for. Reporter Corrine Hess visited Gateway Technical College to see what students there are learning.
You may think of loud, heavy machines clanking together in a dirty shop when you imagine a job in manufacturing. But the industry doesn't sound that way anymore, and neither does a classroom. Dan Lubrano moves from machine to machine in his advanced manufacturing class. It is set up as an open lab.
Working with a dial caliper.
Students can use anything from protractors to computer programs that teach them robotics to the basics of electrical circuits.
Yeah, with the fuse, it's disposable, basically.
Lubrano is soft-spoken, 32. He has two arm-length tattoos. One says Lubrano in Old English lettering. The other says the name of his daughter, Ariana. Last year, Lubrano saw a billboard for Gateway's new advanced manufacturing degree developed for Foxconn while he was driving in his hometown of Racine. When he graduated from Park High School, he wasn't thinking much about his future. After spending about 8 years working retail and fast food jobs, Lubrano got a job at Thermo Transfer Products in Racine.
I wasn't really goal-oriented at that time, unfortunately. It was just kind of, you know, you kind of got to put your hands to work and, you know, make a living, you know, and that's what I did. I just went out and found a job, and it actually became pretty interesting over time.
He's hoping what he learns at Gateway will teach him enough to quit his current job. Maybe it will lead to a job at Foxconn or another manufacturer in southeastern Wisconsin. If Lubrano chooses the right vocation, he could even land a six-figure salary. No company has made more promises to Wisconsin's potential workforce than Foxconn. The company is planning to build a $10 billion, 20 million square foot manufacturing complex just east of I-94 in Racine County. An agreement between the company and Gateway, signed in early 2018, says Foxconn will hire 236 people skilled in advanced manufacturing by year five. The company anticipates hiring 46 supply chain graduates by then. Tony Lestan spent 25 years working with large manufacturers in Racine and Milwaukee. He became a full-time instructor at Gateway in mid-2018.
We had a lot of trouble finding personnel, even at rather elevated salaries. So when the opportunity came up to help fill that gap, I felt that I owed it to industry and I owed it to people, because I think it really helps elevate people's standard of living to get that better salary, to learn the skills that we really need right now.
Foxconn is what drew Amber Hiron to Gateway. The 31-year-old has been driving a forklift at a company in Racine for the last several years. She originally thought about working on a production line. Now she's thinking about a career in engineering.
I decided to go, you know, kind of behind the scenes, engineering part of it, more working with your brain instead of your body, because that can be kind of hard on you. I really don't know what to expect. It's just kind of a learning curve.
Hiron's not sure where she will end up working, and Foxconn's plans for hiring have been fluid. But Lestan says even if his students aren't hired by Foxconn, they will have no trouble finding jobs at other manufacturing companies. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the groups that organize high school athletics in Wisconsin and around the country have a message for parents on the sidelines. Keep calm and leave the referees alone. we'll find out why crabby parents, yelling parents, may be creating a referee shortage in youth sports around the state and around the country. We'll ask for your calls, by the way, your stories of what you've seen on sidelines as a coach, as a parent, or maybe even as a ref yourself. You can even email your story now, ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear what you've seen out there. Also on the show tomorrow, the American Psychological Association has issued new guidelines on how to treat the psychological needs of men in particular, and concerns about men maybe not seeking out psychological treatment when they need it. We'll find out what these new guidelines could mean for men who are seeking psychological help. And we'll travel back in time. We'll meet a person who's collected a whole bunch of vintage beer signs and hear about some of the stories involved in collecting those over time. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Kate's guest gives us the latest on the federal government's partial shutdown and how the lack of pay and uncertainty about the future is affecting many federal employees. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the latest developments in the Trump-Russia probe, including news that the FBI opened a counterintelligence investigation into the president last year. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.